This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello there, I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and in this episode I'm talking to comedian, MC, writer and promoter Stephen Grant.
I started out in comedy, like I said, in 97, and the whole thing was that my approach to it was fascination in this black art, you know, and trying to work out what it is that made some things tick, one things didn't. And like all enthusiastic but ultimately non-natural comics, and I'm not a natural comic, that's another subject I'm very interested in, is the difference between sort of the old idea behind born comics and people who learn the job. I learned through mistakes. Okay. I understood there were lots of different ways of doing comedy, and I probably tried all of them, and I just dismissed them one at a time when they didn't work. I mean, if I was a police detective looking for a murderer, I'd accuse everybody and then one by one whittle them down until, sure, I found someone who did it.
Sure,
right.
Okay.
And that was my approach. My approach was, I don't understand how this works, but I'm going to find out by trying everything.
Okay.
And dismissing everything that doesn't.
Okay. Okay. So that, I mean, that's fascinating I've never heard anyone say that before. I'm not a natural comic. I sometimes feel that about myself. I feel like the only way I'm doing this is, I might think, oh, I'm naturally quite charismatic, but I'm not naturally funny. I'm not one of those people who can get a laugh without knowing how they get the laugh, or I can't even quite.
I'm not going to oversimplify it, because I reckon I could write a book on this.
Go on.
But I think there are certain things that are natural: your natural charisma, natural empathy, natural presence, mm-hmm, natural timing. I mean, that's probably the most important one. Mm-hmm. Okay, which most people, like, you can be a really funny writer and not have great timing.
Yes.
But you probably never make it as a performer. And I could list about 20 people we know that would be like that. But naturally funny, as, yes, in a radar.
You can have all of those things without being naturally funny, can't you? Yeah.
But naturally funny is the radar to tell you immediately how something is funny straight away. Yeah. It's not just even the ability to be able to come up with something immediately, because if I was going to say, oh, what's my unique selling point? If someone says to me, well, what makes you better than other comics? I think, well, actually, I'm probably as quick a thinker as, yeah, there is on my feet, on stage, and I've got an idea for most situations. But that's something that, you know, I understand is only one piece of a jigsaw, and,
yes,
and there is a lot more to it. And in some instances, that ability is pointless anyway. So it's not as if, you know, I could live off that.
Sure.
But that ability to be zoned in, to be able to go, you know what, this is. If someone says the phone book out loud, it would be funny. I think,
yes,
it's an oversimplification, but what they mean is they've got funny bones, right?
Yes. Yes.
How many people in the UK within our industry have got that? I'd say probably about 15. That's,
yeah,
it, maximum. And probably only a couple of them are British.
I think
the majority of them are overseas. There is a depressingly large amount of natural ability in visiting Canadian comics.
Yeah, I was going to say. What sort of people are we thinking about? And the first one I thought was Craig, actually.
Right, well, Craig Campbell, yes. But,
yeah,
but then also Tom Stade as well.
Yeah,
is a natural comic.
Yeah.
But do you want the rather depressing industry view of what makes a natural comic?
God, yeah.
Someone who is still constantly working at the top of the level despite being, as an individual, so unprofessional in any other job nobody would employ them, because,
okay,
they've just got that. They could barrel up 20 minutes late without any shoes on, off their face,
mm-hmm,
stumble on stage and be brilliant and stumble off again.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people mistake that excesses of human activity as a byproduct of their ability. It's not. Comics, on the whole, aren't depressive, terrible people.
Sure.
But the natural comics have got that ability to be funny despite being that.
Yes, okay.
The world is full of crap alcoholics and depressive people who've got no abilities in life, but are brilliantly funny,
mm,
right? But thankfully, or sadly, comedy is one of these jobs that you can continue to do,
mm,
while still at the absolute depths of a nervous breakdown. And that's why people go, oh, loads of comedians are depressed. No, just loads of depressed people in other industries don't continue to work.
I totally agree with that.
But in comedy, they do.
Analysis, yeah, absolutely.
Right? You know, it's that's...
I've often thought that with, as you know, my background in street performing, that it allows you, because it has nothing else attached to it, you don't need to turn up on time, all those sort of things, it allows people to continue being depressive and alcoholics to an effective functional level, whereas in a real job they wouldn't be able to function.
And the absolute upshot of this is I'm definitely not a natural comic, but I can tell you probably about 10 people who I think are at the absolute top of their game are also not natural comics. I don't think Jimmy Carr's a natural comic. I think he's an excellent grafter and he's got a finely tuned radar. I don't think Dave Gorman is a natural comic. I think that is a man who has a real nose for a great idea and how to extrapolate the comedy out of it. But those are all decisions he's made. Those are all understanding of what make something funny. He wasn't born with that ability. He has worked towards it, and it's not to do with these people, you know, had a tough time being a comic in the first 2 or 3 years. It is just, you know, I mean, you know, people don't also mistake being a born comic for being effortless comic. I mean, like, Mickey Flanagan is an effortless comic. Mickey Flanagan tells material that you sit there and you think, oh, that is brilliant, but you know what, I don't think I could ever deliver it as good as that. Or, you know, and also you look at Mickey as well, and I've never had respect for him going, I'm tired, because I've watched him even doing an hour and I'm thinking, I know a lot of work went into that, but you don't look tired.
I see what you mean, you don't
sound any more tired than when you walked off.
I
remember watching Lee Evans when I was a 15 year old, and he would have this suit that by the end of it
nearly kills him every time,
dishcloth. And I'd be sitting there and I'm thinking, well, that man's putting everything into it. Well, don't get me wrong, Mickey Flanagan's putting everything into it, okay, but you can't see it. You know, maybe it's that whole thing of a duck that's serene above the water and
absolutely.
His feet going flat out underneath. But I still don't think Mickey Flanagan is a natural comic. I think you have to look more like people like Adam Bloom, someone who's wired for comedy. Sean Walsh, to some extent, is someone you look at and you sort of think, if you didn't do this, what the hell would you do? But still possibly not a natural comic, because he like all of us will sit down and write something, I think that's funny, and try out and don't know. And natural comics have just got words come out of their mouth with the metronome of somebody who has told that joke 100 times before. They automatically inherit the fine tuning and experience and just basic raw timing that the rest of us get through trial and error.
So, in terms of your own career, at what point did you come to this realization about yourself? If you said there was presumably a point where you went, not going to be a natural.
Quite long into it, actually.
Okay.
Because
because
you get confused, because people come up to you after you have a great gig and go, oh, you're brilliant, you're a natural.
And then
you go off and think, I'm a natural. and then eventually you get to know other comics better. In fact, if Stephen Grant 15 and a half, well, 16 years of experience probably by the time you edit this goes out, was able to travel back in time and talk to Stephen Grant, 6 months of experience, and give him one piece of advice, I mean, there would be lots, but if I could only pick one to give him, it would say, spend more time talking and getting to know and not just competing with and annoying your fellow comics. Because watching comedy, you learn as much from comedy as you do doing comedy. I mean, you don't learn enough to be able to make you perform, but you learn as much. And another wonderful thing about stand-up comedy's rich tapestry is that people approach it from all angles. No one ever turns to a stand-up comic and said, drama school from the age of 12, there's rich people who gave up to do comedy. There are poor people. There are people who had phenomenal jobs. There are people who had no jobs and this is their only job. There are people who've got degrees. There are people who've got no education. There are people who did this because they have an urge to be on stage and be seen. There's people who do this despite the fact the last place they would want to be is on stage and being seen. There is no... If you were to draw a kind of one of those sort of government diagrams that show people's industries and then put stand-up comedy in a circle in the middle, you could draw a line from everything. So each one of these people have got a different reason, and each of those reasons are valid. And if you learn those early on, it gives you this much more what's the word I'm looking for? It gives you a much more sort of philosophical approach to the world of stand-up, because you go, you know what, Stephen, because it's not a path, even though it's a career, because it's not something where you could turn to someone on one side and say, I want to be a stand-up, and say, okay, well, these are the steps that you need
sure,
to do.
Sure.
You do have to look at it as a calling to some extent. And the reason why it's a calling is because the idea to do it, the idea to see it through, the idea to be it, has to come from within you, because there's no external path that's recognised.
Okay.
The reason why I realised I wasn't a natural comic was because, and you know, I said this thing about, oh, I go back in time and tell myself to talk to other comics
sure,
around me,
sure,
is I hadn't been paying enough attention to the other people around me who'd been doing stand-up. I was a little bit too wrapped up in myself, wrapped up in my own material, wrapped up in my own job. How do I do this? Mm-hmm. And I should have realised that other people, just seen the difference between other people having to work at it and other people that weren't, and they were just arriving with the skills, even though they'd never learnt them. Because it was when I started realising, because I sometimes thought that comedy was a little bit unfair when I was way too competitive and I saw people just...
Comedy is unfair!
Well, it is unfair, but it's nowhere near as unfair as music or acting. I mean,
sure,
comedy is a meritocracy. I still maintain that if you are brilliantly funny,
yeah,
you will be huge.
Sure.
But I am certain there are brilliantly talented actors and musicians out there
who
are earning nothing
ever,
and yeah, they will yeah, never yeah, yeah, do it, right? So,
sure.
And why is comedy like that? Well, partly because not everyone wants to do it, so the pool of talent is smaller, mm-hmm, but mainly because it's really difficult. And
yeah,
once you're at the level that we're at, we forget the fact that it's difficult. And
yes,
then you bump into open spots and you see how hard they're trying to get to where we are. And then you remember, oh yeah, this is difficult.
Sure.
Right. So the reason why I realised is because I started meeting people whose careers were just in complete ascendancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to work out why, you know. And at first you think, oh, why are they getting luck? Oh, it's because they're young. Oh, they've got skinny jeans
sure,
on. Oh,
sure,
because they're good looking. Oh, because they got a better agent than me. Oh,
yeah,
because they got lucky on this. Oh, they got given an award. Awards are random. Right. And then you just go, oh, hang on. No, the reason is, it's because they've got something about them that they arrived with and they haven't learned. And they haven't had to grind out through the trial and error process I described to you right at the beginning. Mm. They've not, when they've walked on stage and they've made a decision, it's more likely to be right than wrong. It hasn't been like me when it's a toss of a coin, and when it's wrong, I had to go off and think
that's
about
very
it in the car
perceptive,
journey home.
That difference,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just if you ever watch late night poker, which a lot of comics do as well, and you see it on TV, and you see the people who are absolutely top poker players, you know, and the commentators, I think there's a guy called Jesse Mann, he goes, oh, he's got the skill, he's got the the racket's in his pocket, you know, this, right? And you sort of sit there and you think, but it's a card game, the cards are shuffled and all the rest of it. And then you realise, well, you know what, it's just nous, it's just that little bit of, I've arrived at the table with what for an unseasoned viewer would look like permanent luck, and it's not, it's just a way about them that allows them to nail it. And once I realised that those people had that, I realised that my path is not that route. But
and
I reassured myself by pointing out the fact that there are people at the top of the game who don't have that.
Okay, because I was going to say, was that a painful experience? I sometimes feel I'm at war with myself, and I think a lot of us are at war with ourselves as to whether we should be doing this, you know, whether we are maybe born comics or not, or maybe we see people that we want to be as good as and we think, I can't ever be that, or I want to be that. There's a kind of a war going on, and because it's all about ourselves and it's all focused inwards, it can be a very emotionally painful process. It's almost like you're describing the point where you thought, I want to be amazing at this, and then you thought, oh well, I can't be, and then you thought, oh, I can do the best I can.
Well,
was that difficult? Did that hurt?
Well, to be honest with you, you sound a lot more driven than I do. I know it sounds daft because obviously I work, but I didn't. I was trying to analyse other people's careers. I was looking at other people and saying, well, why is it that they've got what they've got?
Sure.
Taking into account, I believe comedy is a meritocracy, and I think it's because of that. The word X factor has been buggered by the X factor.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
ultimately it's that. Ultimately it's that look. And then it does come down to things that people are a bit more cynical about. Like, are you the right person at the right time? You know, I saw someone, a seasoned journalist recently, write on Twitter, would Sarah Millican be as successful if it wasn't for her Geordie accent?
Sure.
Right. And I just thought, well, that's a little harsh for an extremely hardworking, extremely talented woman. And then I thought, okay, well, let's look at the question subjectively. if she wasn't, would she be as successful? And nobody really can say hand on heart that that is definitely the case. No one can really say hand on heart that with the whole package altogether, if you were to take one element out, that from a point of view of the science of comedy, should make no difference. Though admittedly, regional accents do tend to make things funnier. Would that make her any less successful? And the answer is, it could make no difference, or it can make all the difference. But because...
it wouldn't make any difference to how funny she was, or how hardworking she was, but it might make a difference to the available opportunities.
We don't have parallel universes, but the only way that we would be more certain... well, you know, and in that one, I'm absolutely nailing this podcast. but if there was, by point of reference, another female comic from the same background on the industry right now who had everything that she had, work ethic, drive, ability, skill, but didn't have an regional accent and was going nowhere, you could go, aha, right, that is definitely the case, you know. But that's not how it works. How it works. And so you know, the level below the natural ability, the level below the meritocracy, there is an argument that you tick a box, that you fill a gap that the industry's been looking for. You know, when people talk about Ava Vidal and Andy Osho, and and they're unfairly compared because ultimately they're very different acts, and they're also just comics like the rest of us, right? But because both of them are good-looking female black performers, you know, automatically people get that comparison. Why do they get that comparison automatically? Because take those two away, and there isn't anybody you can really think of that is an emerging good-looking black female comic, whereas we are white middle-class home counties. We are fodder. We're in the event of a war. Andy Osho and Ava Vidal are in the major's office arguing strategy, while we are in the trenches. Having grenades. We are literally filling up the background. We are the majority. And so when you're in that position like us, you can be quite, and I believe quite unfairly, this is not an argument I'm making because I believe it's an argument I'm making because I think this is made too often. You can be quite unfairly sitting there thinking, well, of course those people have got that because they are ticking that box. But underlying all of this is that it is a meritocracy. There is nobody there, who isn't there on merit. And with this is why when someone turns to me and goes, oh, that Jack White, oh, I absolutely hate him, shit. And I go, you know what? There is nothing wrong with what you said there except the bit at the end. And what you need to say is, I think he's shit, not he's shit. One of them's an opinion, the other one is a statement. And I'll explain to you why he isn't shit. And the reason why he isn't shit is because he wouldn't have got to where he was. But he's just young and all the girls looking. Trust me, there are good looking blokes all over the world who aren't famous, who aren't successful, who haven't got talent. Trust me, there is talent and ability there. What we're hearing is the manifestation of jealousy. But because why wouldn't you be jealous of someone that talented, good looking and capable? And also a failure to understand why people succeed in this industry. And that's the weirdest thing about comedy.
If you look at someone like Mickey Flanagan, who was floating around at the top of the circuit being brilliant for years and then suddenly went stratospheric, surely the way you're describing things in this case, that, you know, he wouldn't have got stratospheric, he wouldn't have got massive without being as brilliant as he is. But do you also think that there are people, you know, there are people on the circuit who are brilliant but not stratospheric, for whom it isn't quite happening as much? Take Tom Stade, for example. Tom's absolutely fantastic. He's not suddenly become as famous or popular or successful as Mickey. He's not selling out Wembley Arena.
No.
So how does that fit into that system of understanding? I mean, is it just luck?
I mean, at that level, at Mickey's level, you've also got to be good at the job. You know, and I don't say Tom's not good at the job, but I'm just saying, but Mickey plays the game. He's in the right places, doing the right tours, getting the right PR, agent making the right decisions.
Agent making the right decisions, that's out of Mickey's hands. That's out of his, you know what I mean?
Mickey still appoints the agent. You know, as Dave Gorman has said repeatedly to comics, agents work for you, not the other way around. You know, if your agent's not doing the right thing, then you get rid of the agent and you get a new agent, or you go it alone. I mean, it's not impossible in this industry.
I suppose what I'm getting at is, do you think luck plays a part, or is it purely you don't think luck plays any part at all?
I think luck. This is not about visualizing your success and going, I know I will be there. But I think luck affects mostly these things. It affects the rate at which you get the success you achieve, you deserve.
Yeah.
The rate, okay? So,
so it might be that we have this conversation in 2 years and Tom Stade has just sold out Wembley Arena.
Look, take Andy Murray, right? Right now, the Australian Open's on right now. I mean, by the time the podcast comes out, it might be over, I don't know. But the upshot of it is that he won a Grand Slam on merit. Mm-hmm. He was unlucky that it took him 5 goes.
Okay.
Right?
Okay, yeah.
So his ability is Grand Slam winner. His luck was bad luck that it took him better part of 4 years.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Same for Mickey Flanagan. Mickey Flanagan always had that ability. Mm-hmm. Surprised people, you know, and you say suddenly, I know, what doesn't seem suddenly to me,
sure,
you know, there was 2 year period when he was coming doing gigs and he was brilliant and then he was too good for the gig and then he wasn't doing the gig because he was doing something better,
sure,
and then that thing he was doing better he was brilliant at, and then it was, you know, I didn't feel like suddenly to me, it just felt like his progress hadn't been checked.
Sure.
You know, it just felt like...
I was
like
just meaning so sudden from the point of view of the last time I did a gig with him on the circuit to the fact he was... to the time he was a household name. For me, that period happened within sort of 3 years from... And that's what how fast it happened for Sarah as well, I would say.
Yes. However, it doesn't take long to be offered a bit of work.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And it doesn't take long to be offered something slightly better if you do really well at it.
Of course.
Right. So it's not quick for these people.
Yeah,
they're just progressing through doing really well at each job at that level. We would all progress that quickly if every time we were given a job, we were not just good at it, but brilliant at it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't believe it's not like. You know, you sometimes get people in the audience come up to you after gigs if it's somewhere where they've seen you a lot of times. And obviously that happens to me a lot because I've got the gig in Brighton. And people come up to me and go, oh, you're always here. Do you have this, well, you know, just waiting for your lucky break.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it could be luck that somebody's in the audience at that point in time and they give me a fuck up. Like, for example, I mean, Sean Walsh, who I know very well and I write with him, got onto Mock the Week because the people who booked Mock the Week sent someone down to Brighton to see Zoe Lyons, who's been on it a few times, and Sean just so happened to be doing 10 minutes that night.
Mm-hmm.
Just so happened, you know. And those are the bits in the industry where other comics go, how lucky is that, right? Trust me, he would have been on it. It just would have taken a little bit longer.
Of course.
All luck does is affect the rate at which you get to where you get to.
You were saying before, it sounded like there was a list. You said luck affects the rate at which your success happens, and then we digressed on that. What were the other components?
What else are luck affects?
Yes.
Well, I mean... Well, actually, I've been brutally honest. Luck affects the other things in your life, which will then affect your comedy.
Yes.
You know, I have a very well-publicised, like internationally publicised divorce, which you could consider unlucky.
You were publicising it internationally.
Let's be brutally honest with you. I publicised this locally.
Yeah.
I told my local paper because I had a local gig coming up at the Brighton Comedy Festival.
Yeah.
And then a press agency sold that story internationally.
Okay, sorry. When you said you publicised internationally, I thought you meant you'd been on gigs such as the one we're currently in Doha in Qatar.
Oh, well, no.
And you're talking about it on stage.
No, I don't talk about it that often, to be honest, if at all, really. Just because, ironically, I don't have particularly good jokes about it, considering it's such a monumental thing. And I was, you know, you could say that the luck you had in your life elsewhere affects your comedy, but you know, I still believe that you are 95% in charge of your own life anyway, so that's what happens. So luck, external influences, you know, and for every single comic, the Jimmy Carr's, Mickey Flanagan's, Sarah Millican's, Jack Whitehall's, Russell Howard's, you know, even that kind of one level below where with very established acts but maybe not household names are Mark Watson's, even Stephen Merchant to some extent. Look at their success, right? And I promise you there is something that's happened in their personal life that they've either had to forego or let fall by the wayside. There has been large chunks of just day-to-day life that because they're such determined, single focused, narrow-minded, well, not narrow-minded, that sounds a bit negative, but sort of narrow focused individuals, they've had to forego.
Yeah.
You know. And you know, coming back to something you said about 20 minutes ago when you said, oh, you know, that these people, you know, what's the difference between Tom Stade and Mickey Flanagan, you know, and I'd say from the point of view of actual raw talent, probably nothing.
What defines success for you? And are you happy with your lot?
Well, I'm desperately happy with my lot in as much as I have a wonderful life outside of comedy now. Which I, and there was a large chunk of my comedy career when I thought the two couldn't live alongside each other. The large chunk of my comedy career when I looked at things not going well outside of comedy and thought that's because of comedy.
Yeah.
Because to achieve what you do even at our level now, we've had to give up something or work very hard on something that that means we've had to prioritise what other people wouldn't. Bearing in mind this started as a hobby.
Sure.
You know, there was a time when the hobby became a career. But what do hobbies and careers have in common? That you can be obsessed with them.
Yeah.
So clearly, there was a undercurrent of obsession running throughout the whole thing. So what happens is you get the comic comes off, has a great gig and all the rest of it, and then he's really, really miserable. And you sort of think, oh, that might be because he's a manic depressive, and that's what comics are, though. Why? They're not. Maybe the rest of their life is shit because that's what they had to do in order to become great at comedy.
Yes.
Okay. Or maybe it's what they felt they had to do.
Yes.
But I know as many really established comics now who are perfectly happy in their day-to-day life as I know ones who are troubled.
Yes.
Right? So that is a fallacy to think that the two go hand in hand. The problem is that when you have success in one and failure in the other, you automatically, as a human being, have...
You
blame them in between. Flip side of the coin as well. You know, if someone's having a really sort of normal life, but their comedy's not going anywhere, they think, you know what, I'm spending too much time on this, I should spend more time on the comedy. They will, and comics are terrible for that. Comics will quite literally harpoon a perfectly happy life in order to take risks with their career, despite there being no guarantees that it will make any difference.
I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about.
So this is Stephen Grant, and I have to say I had no idea his approach to comedy was so scientific. It's fascinating to hear someone deal with the various challenges of the circuit and of the job with such a reasoned, evidence-based analysis of what works and what doesn't work for him. It's brilliant. Stephen's going to walk us through the creation and the development of one of his favourite new jokes, as well as going into detail of the different techniques he uses when writing with other acts, with specific reference there to Sean Walsh and Russell Kane, as well as Simon Brodkin, a.k.a. Lee Nelson. And there's even more from this. We talked for ages. As you'll hear, me and Stephen were on an international gig together. This was recorded in Qatar, and we've got bags of additional stuff, so it's about 35 minutes available to download for free at www.comedianscomedian.com/Stephen, that's Stephen with a PH, in which Mr. Grant will be discussing the frustrating period where he felt he couldn't move up in the industry without a more clearly defined persona and his solution to that challenge. He'll be talking about his note taking system, his approach to international gigs, and he also goes into a lot of detail on the pros and cons of running one's own club, in his case the excellent Crater Comedy at the Comedia in Brighton and in Bath. So if you're thinking about setting up your own club, you would be well advised to give that a listen, and even if you're not, really fascinating stuff from a real insider in the industry in lots of different ways. So it's very nearly your last chance to buy tickets for James Acaster on Wednesday the 6th of February. That's next Wednesday now, and I can stop banging on about it because it'll have happened. One lucky listener wins a free ticket because they correctly deduced the answer to the cryptic crossword I set you, and I'm pleased to tell you that the winner is Mr. Dan Foraker. So he wins a ticket for next Wednesday night, having correctly worked out that the answer was Stu Goldsmith. Sorry for putting myself as a clue, as an answer, but I was going on holiday and I was quite giddy. So just to go through that very quickly for the nerds among you, messed up is an anagram of guts, that's S-T-U-G, senior is old, a metal worker is a smith, and thanks to the cancellation of a kid's sci-fi TV show I did, I am in fact a discontinued cyborg. So thanks to Dan, you win a ticket, and more importantly, the respect of your peers, I imagine. Now, back to Stephen Grant.
Let's talk about analysis. Let's talk about process as it applies to your writing.
Okay.
Because you are you are, like we've said, you're someone that thinks about it all the time. Mm. You breathe comedy, you know, and you do in the work that you do. You write with other people. You write for other people. But let's focus for the moment on the writing you do.
I know I breathe comedy. Do you know why? Because it's tax return time, and then every time my accountant looks at what does and he goes, "All your phone calls and travel can't all be comedy. Sure, you're doing other stuff," and you're going, no, I'm not doing other stuff.
Yeah, no, I have that argument.
Because surely at least 20%.
There's got to be something else in your life, Stephen.
20% of your phone calls have got to be just to friends asking how they are. No. No. Any idea? It's ridiculous. Anyway, yeah, go on.
So, let's talk about the process. One of the things I'm interested in is the journey from an idea to the page or the computer to the stage. So let's go. How do you start? What's your current favourite bit of material? And let's work backwards and see where that came from.
You know what? I've never done it working backwards. I can tell you it working forwards.
Oh, cool. No problems whatsoever.
No, I'm going to try doing it working backwards. Because it's much funnier then, because at least you hear the joke, then you're interested in it, and you find out how it goes. Because if you do it forwards,
yeah, you already know the
then you already know the joke. Yeah. So the current joke, and I did it last night on stage, and it's probably only about the fifth or sixth time I've done it now, and I think I've just about got it right. And it's about the fact that my baby boy has got a cold, but I found out that children can't clear their own nostrils until they're 2 years old. Up until then, mm-hmm. they've just got a blocked nose and they can't breathe. It makes it really hard for them to sleep. And so I'm asking the doctor how to clear his nose, and sure. he said, what you need to do is suck it out. So I get one of these little things, these little devices to suck it out, and it doesn't work. And I said, well, it's not working, what should I do? And he goes, no, you misunderstand me, you have to suck it out. And so I think, well, you know what, I love my baby boy, you know, this is all about being a dad, I've got to make decisions and do things I didn't used to have to do. So I cover his mouth, I put my mouth over his nose, suck all the snot out, you know, and I did that because I love him. Of course, if I really loved him, I would have swallowed. Right, now that's a joke, very obvious.
People were screaming at that last night.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, don't let this piss poor delivery onto a podcast in any way dissuaded from the quality of that gag.
No, they'll be steering off the road for this, don't
Right, so anyway, so there's the joke. And then with the topper, which I'm still experimenting with right now, and he goes, and when people are going, oh, that's horrible, and I'm going, well, you say that, I'm just more worried about when he becomes constipated. Mm-hmm. Okay, so good sort of topper joke there. So let's go back a bit. Well, first of all, that's not how I've told it the three or four times before it. The times I've said before it, there's been a little bit less padding. Now, I don't usually like padding in a joke, but it's needed padding. Because the first time I told it, I said my baby boy had a blocked nose, and the doctor said I had to suck it out with my mouth. Mm-hmm. So I said there. And I get a, ugh.
Yes, I
right?
see. Okay.
Because what I've done there is I've set the setup
yeah.
has got a mental image, which
yes.
is horrible.
Yes,
so the people have been switched off to the point of view of comedy.
Yeah.
And I said, so I did it like that. And at that point, they're going, oh, too much information. Yes, and he goes, yes. you know, and I did that because I love him. Of course, if I really loved him, would have swallowed. But not got as much of a laugh then, because too many people have got too graphic a mental image.
Yeah.
And the natural thing you do in that situation is you switch off.
Yes.
You know,
and also
so it's detached.
The cliffs are a bit too close together there as well, because if you're immediately saying to begin with that you suck it out, then mm-hmm. you're using up that reaction that...
I don't want that reaction. Yeah. I'm trying to find a way of doing the joke without the reaction. You know, okay. the reaction of disgust is taking people off Funny Street and is putting them on Disgust Street.
I understand.
Right?
I understand.
Okay, they're too close together.
Yeah.
So I had to put something before it. You know, so I had to... So that was how the joke existed before. And then the topper was much more horrible, because I used to say, yeah, and he goes, you think that's bad? The following week, he was constipated.
Yeah.
I had been brushing my teeth for a fortnight.
Oh,
okay, right, yeah. You're all disgusted and you work in the industry. So there you go. So I've got the root of a good joke, but the delivery's not been there. So there's been three or four goes. And again, this goes back to the same how I started out in comedy.
Okay.
I think a natural comic would know how to say this in
yeah.
such a way that the audience weren't disgusted. Okay,
sure.
So I'm telling it each night.
Mm.
The joke is strong enough that it gets a laugh regardless,
mm-hmm.
but the difference between it being an okay laugh and an amazing laugh is all going to be in that setup. It's all about where you've put people's heads just before you hit the punch. Okay, so where does it go before then? Well, before then, like a lot of comics' ideas, it's based on truth.
Mm-hmm.
He has got a blocked nose. I did once have to suck it out. I found that out not because the doctor told me, because the doctor is a dramatic inference. It wasn't a doctor. We Googled it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just but Googled. It's not nowhere near.
Yeah.
Whereas it was the trial. I went to the doctor with his blocked nose, and you know what he said to me? I don't know. There was an explosion in the background.
Can't imagine how many, if comedians were forced to tell the truth, how many setups would involve. So I was Googling X the other day. You know, but that's not a.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I was Googling everything you've heard.
Yeah.
As a setup. And I've done the punchlines first. But normally you'll come up with the punchline first, then you'll get... So we're going back. So truth is the basis of this one.
Yeah.
Okay. And this will be good for your podcast as well. Me then coming up with the idea behind it and putting it as a tweet on Twitter.
Okay.
And then getting response. And I will put my hand up and say the idea for the constipation
mm-hmm.
came from a couple of replies, including
yeah.
Jenny Eclair. who replied to me saying, said to me, he said, you can't use that technique when they're constipated.
Yeah, exactly.
I had the idea of constipation before then, but nowhere near as clever, this whole idea. I just had this whole idea of the fact that, my original idea was the whole idea of the fact that you would, that you both feeding and helping a baby would involve just blowing it in and sucking it back out again. You know, that effectively the baby was like a massive bagpipe.
Yeah.
Right. That was my initial idea, but it was way too graphic, way too complicated. Didn't use it. And then when you see a joke on a tweet, by the way, it's automatically sharp because it's only 140 characters. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not many flabby jokes on Twitter. There's some, but they're not hugely flabby. Anyway, so I had the idea and I wrote it on Twitter and then people came back. Before then, where did the actual joke come from? Where did the whole idea of he's got a blocked nose, you suck it out, come from? And that's horrible. Well, the thought of it. Because when you're tuned into the world of comedy, you tend to look at everything as a sitcom or a comic film or a punchline, and you say things with the metronome of comedy, and you just live that environment. I'm not saying you have to do that in order to be funny, but really successful comics don't ever switch off more than 80%, I'd say.
I remember meeting Dara O'Brien for the first time at Ben Norris's birthday party. We were having a chat about street performing, in fact. He said something, and even at the level he was at, even when he's, you know, hosting Mock the Week and all the rest of it, we just, something came up in conversation, and he went, "Oh, is that funny? Yeah, hold on, sorry." And then he got out his BlackBerry and he made a note of it.
Of course.
Yeah, at a birthday party at 1 a.m.
Yes, because if you don't, because let me tell you to all those people listening right now who aren't comics or aren't involved in the world of comedy, if you had come up with a really funny idea and you don't write it down there and then, what you remember later on is the fact that you came up with a funny idea.
That's absolutely,
but not any of the content.
Yeah.
Because what you have a moment of inspiration, and then you have a 10-second warm glow of, oh, I've just thought of something great, and that's the bit you remember. Yeah. Useless.
Yeah, I've never managed to come up with you'd think there'd be some sort of Derren Brown-esque memory pegging system for ideas, whereby you could slot it into some. I'm sure someone like Paul Sinner could slot it into something in his memory palace or whatever it is. But no, I've never been able to do that.
And the idea of if you really love them, they'd swallow was an idea that I had while talking to Nick Page, another comic. Again, this thing that we told myself years ago is talk to other comics. It's amazing what you can do. I've given toppers to loads of comics jokes and, you know, extra ideas for people's jokes, and I've gone, why don't you put that in your act? And I've never thought, oh, you know, give me some money for it, that was ridiculous. It's you know, it's big community, you know, we should work together like that. And likewise, you know, that's happened to me as well, coming back the other way. But typically it will be just ideas. So that's my system. It's an extension on writing down bits of paper. You absolutely should do it on a phone or on a computer, and you should always do it with something that has the cloud access, so that it automatically updates.
Sure,
because
sure.
People say, oh, we've got to back up. No one ever remembers to back up, especially if you're a comic and you're trying to think of jokes. You know, do something that automatically backs up so you never lose it. Losing jokes is a horrible feeling.
Do you ever write by starting with an idea where nothing has already occurred to you and trying to pull things out of that idea? Or do you always go from the "this occurs to me," turn it into a joke? Do you ever sit down and write, okay, well, to use an example that Josh Whittaker talks about in the podcast, do you ever think, okay, right, it's Christmas coming up, let's think of Christmas things, mistletoe, you write down the word mistletoe and try and find funny stuff about it? Or is it always the other way around?
Well, I've got two modes of writing. One of them is Edinburgh show and one of them is circuit, and obviously there's crossover because you've got an audience trying to be funny, and sometimes you write stuff for an Edinburgh show and it'll end up in your circuit routines, sometimes you write circuit routines that'll end up in your Edinburgh show. But the whole idea of start with an idea, what's funny about that, is my Edinburgh show writing method.
Gotcha.
Because I don't feel constrained when writing an Edinburgh show. If I end up with an observation that I think is 3 or 4 minutes long but is peppered with interesting facts, that's absolutely fine for Edinburgh. I think it's too conceited and too selfish to do that in a circuit environment when people have paid for comedy to hear something snappy.
Sure. Just to, as a sort of contrary view, do you think that in an Edinburgh show then you have the time to do that, or would you not want in an Edinburgh show to go out there with an hour of club funny stuff?
I think
short,
the problem
tight,
with,
home
there's nothing wrong
stuff.
With doing an hour of club funny stuff in Edinburgh, but you will be absolutely massacred by the critics because that's not what Edinburgh's about, and rightly so, because they can see that the 11 months of the year elsewhere. All right.
Okay.
And secondly, why would you do that? Why have a buffet restaurant? And this is obviously, while we're in the Middle East, this is clearly fresh moment. But why have a massive buffet and just eat bread? I mean, this is it. You've got to expand to the breadth of the format in front of you. And Edinburgh gives you the opportunity to do wider ideas and concepts. Don't turn up in Edinburgh with the stuff that works everywhere else. There's nothing wrong with it, but what's the point?
The point is to go up there, and you know this is your chance to get noticed, and you want to not be able to put a playing card in between all the punchlines.
I am very career in many ways, but I'm a bit of a purist when it comes to Edinburgh as well. If you're going up to Edinburgh in order to forward your career, to show the best of what you do, right, to be the snappiest and sharpest and treat it as a trade fair, that's absolutely fine. You're paying through the nose for it. That is totally your prerogative. But think about this from a comedy perspective. Where else and when else will you be able to do the fabulous ideas you have that you dismiss the other 11 months of the year because they won't work on the circuit? What a shame to have all those brilliant thoughts pop into your head and never have an outlet for them. You know, that is, for me, the tragedy of Edinburgh. Is that those concepts are dying off. But thankfully, there is still a core of reviewers and festival goers who want to see that, right? They want to see those ideas. I think it's a shame sometimes that people get pigeonholed. It took me a long time going to Edinburgh. People go, well, he's a circuit compere.
Yeah.
You know, why would we want to go and see an hour of his stuff?
Sure.
You know, and then I would start a show with people walking into a dark room, looking at a blank screen, right, where a computer screen come up and said hello everybody, appear, and they think they're watching a video, so people just sit there and go, you can say hello back. People could gingerly go hello, and I go, so hello the guy in the front row in the blue jumper, and then people go, okay, what the fuck's going on here? And of course I've hidden in the crowd, out of the light, with a wireless keyboard on my lap, and I'm talking to the crowd from a computer attached to a projector on the screen, right? And I do my compare banter in type speed to the people in the crowd. And they love it. And it's just, this is out of the world. Could I do that on the circuit? Of course not, right? Sure. Could I do it in a one-man show? Yes, and I have done, and I've videoed it, and I've put it on a DVD. Very proud of it. My idea, talk to the crowd as if you're grooming them on the internet. And what's great about it is you can make jokes like you would normally do, and then you can go back and delete other things you said. Right? Like, what happens is...
Brilliant.
You know, so you talk to a girl and you go, you are the prettiest person in this room by far, you know, like this, right? Talk to another girl, you are the prettiest... I'm going to say
curse, then
you
it up.
Curse it up, grab the other line, delete it, come back, amazing. In this world by far
lovely.
Bold, right? You know, and then another one as well, and then I'm chatting to people and he goes, what the fuck do you do? You know, this is it. And he goes, oh, can you, hello, I am over here, look at the fucking computer like this, right? Hello, the little girl, well, how old are you? 12. Search and replace, fucking for bloody.
Oh, right, this amazing.
So it's kind of like, you know, these are jokes about people talking online. You can't do that anywhere else. I've had that idea for ages. It took me a long time to set it up technically. All the rest of it, great. Probably not going to win an award for it. Probably not going to even get, you know, that's not going to make any difference to my career. Kudos, definitely. Sense of personal satisfaction, off the scale. Really proud. As proud of that as anything else I've done. Because it was an idea that I had
and
that had
no opportunity,
no opportunity to make it work anywhere else. Arrive at Edinburgh with it. If it didn't work, find something to replace it pretty quick. So from the point of view of the writing process, when it comes to an Edinburgh show, yes, I would Widdicombe-esque write the word mistletoe, draw lots of lines around it, and try to work out what's funny about it, you know.
Josh will be very pleased to hear that described as Widdicombe-esque, but just to take the sting out of that, even having asked the question myself 5 minutes ago, when you said Widdicombe-esque, I did immediately think, what does Anne Widdicombe do about it? sorry, Josh.
I bet Josh absolutely detests the fact that his surname's got that...
connection. Well, maybe that's what drives him, is to become a bigger Widdicombe. Well, let's talk about writing with... other acts and for other acts, because you're someone who has got a huge... Now, I'm not asking you to name people unless you know that you're able to do that, because there is a lot of mystery involved with, you know, helping other people, going down as a programme associate rather than a writer, things like that. So I'm not asking you to spill any beans you don't feel comfortable spilling, but I know that you write with and lots of other people. So which of those can you tell us about? And
I can tell you about pretty much all of them, and the reason why I can tell about all of them is because it would be a lie of me to say... I write their stuff.
Sure.
I write with people at the most. Yes, I write whole jokes that they will say, mm-hmm. but those are not me sat in a room on my own, emailing them over to them, and then saying thanks, invoice me.
Sure.
Right. So I am not doing other people's work for them. I'm channeling the work they're doing. I'm sitting with them, and I'm working very hard on taking their ideas and turning them into jokes at the first instance. But it's an extension of what I've been doing for years as a interfering smartass, talking to comics at a gig and saying, you know what you could do with this, you know what you could do with this, you know, could do this.
And you said doing that was what got you into writing for other people.
Well, I think doing that is what made me realise I'd be good at writing for other people.
Okay.
Like all advances in my career, be it the gigs I run, the gigs I do, the stuff I've done, it's all been proactive. No one has ever phoned me up out of the blue and said, do you fancy doing that? And I thought, that'd be a good idea. Mm. This is me being sitting on my own going, you know what, I should do that.
Yeah.
You know, and the first person I wrote with and the person I've written the most with is Simon Brodkin. And that was as a result of me watching his quite a good show and watching how he banters with the crowd. And I thought, this is really similar to how I do it. It's taking the piss, but it's done with so much charm that no one's genuinely offended. Mm. And also it's snappy and funny, outright. He doesn't need to take time to build up a story. He gets the joke initially.
Yeah.
He then extends it. And then who's laughing the most in the crowd at that point in time? The person he's talking to. Mm. It's not them not laughing and everybody else is.
Sure.
Everyone's laughing, but the person he's talking to is laughing.
He's ferociously talented and driven, all those things. I remember doing open spots with Simon where I was just baffled at how fast he was thinking.
Yeah, but then I saw similarities with myself and I thought, well, you know what? I'm not going to be doing what Simon's doing, but I can definitely probably work alongside him.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote him an email and I just said, look, do you fancy doing some writing together? Because I honestly think I can add value to what you're doing because I think there's similarities. And he went, and he came back to me eventually and said, well, look, come in and do half a day. And if you don't mind, I won't pay you for it, but if I use any of your stuff, then I will.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So I did, and then he did use some of it, and it was fine, and then it was an extra day here, an extra couple of days here, and then it was 4 days here, 5 days here, 2 weeks here, 3 weeks there, you know, and just sort of snowballed from there, really. And he's written with other people as well, but I think he's got a very exacting method.
Mm. You said he's one of the most disciplined people that you write with.
Disciplined on two levels.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, because there's very little wastage in his writing. And there is a lot of wastage in comedy writing. There's a lot of time spent doing stuff that never really turns into anything because it's never quite good enough. Or you think it's brilliant in the writing room, you go out and do it and it dies on its hole.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know. And normally with Simon, I write the darker jokes and Simon goes, they hated me. Thanks, you bastard. That's right. And also because there are courses how to learn comedy out there in the world. But actually, whereas there are certain techniques to do with performing that everyone should learn about where you hold yourself, where you put your eyes, holding the microphone stand, not talking when you put it in because it makes lots of noise, all sorts of things you learn over time, actually nobody says, and this is how you write comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You learn on your own. And quite right so too, because if everybody learned how to write comedy, then we'd be in America.
Mm.
And that is the biggest problem I have with American comedy, is that the formula extends to the creation of it, not just the performing of it. They're more in the world of sitcom and sketch, but ultimately stand up is so diverse in this country because nobody's ever been taken to one side and told how to write it.
Mm-hmm.
So I turn up and I have to learn, and quickly, another comic's established and proven, because they're successful, way of writing stand up.
Sure. Okay.
And in the case of Simon Brodkin, it's enormously disciplined, it's extremely focused, and it's relentless. And by relentless I mean, you know, I make sure that I've had a poo before we start writing.
Yeah.
Because we might not have time.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it because the time goes very quickly. You know, like in any job where you really apply yourself. But, I mean, I would have taken pictures of it, but I think he's a little bit funny about it. But we're sat in a room and every time he says something, it gets written on a whiteboard, The whiteboard runs out of space, it gets written on a post-it note, gets stuck around the whiteboard, and then he'll write stuff down on the sheets of A4 and then that'll be blue-tacked around the wall. We are, you know, 360 degree wallpapered room within 2 days of ideas and jokes, and then they all get copied onto post-it notes, and then their post-it notes get put on an A1 piece of paper in the middle of the desk, and then he keeps getting moved around until he gets the order right.
Okay.
And then he looks at it from a distance and he goes, right, I'm doing that. And then he rolls it up, goes to a gig that night, which is going to be full because it's him. He rolls that out on a table, and he talks off it, looks at it, remembers the idea, gets up, says it, right? So he's never reading off a piece of paper. He remembers it from earlier on in the day. Okay. I mean, his ability to learn material is out there. Good. I mean, have a look at the TV show.
God.
He's written most of it, mm-hmm. as well as performing it, as well as learning it. And he's got his hand in the directing and all the rest of it. He's an advert for seeing your own vision through. Mm. The only problem is that I don't know how the hell he has time to breathe. I mean, the bloke barely sleeps and he works. I thought I worked quite hard, and then I met him and I went, oh, okay, all right, maybe not that hard. And what do? He has an idea, I'll add a joke to it. I'll have an idea, he'll have a joke to it. But with Simon, and this is maybe unique to him, although maybe people do it, there are three stages to a joke. Mm-hmm. There's the idea and the concept, and usually an idea of how it's going to end. There's fleshing it out with the actual joke, turning it into a routine. Mm-hmm. And then there's the finessing. Mm-hmm. There's that word comes out, that word moves there, this bit's superfluous to the setup, that one can refer back to that setup. What I would call what you do on Twitter to make a joke good to brilliant.
Sure.
With the sat there with the electron microscope, taking the corners off stuff. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, when I write with Simon, he does the first and the third bit, and I do the second bit.
Mm-hmm. So the first bit, the inspiration, the having the idea and having a sense of where it's going to go, arguably, taking away the second and third parts, the finesse, the alterations, all the rest of it, that's kind of the crucible, isn't it? That's the where the joke comes from.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. He's had a go with writing other people, and they've just done really horrible stuff about Chav stealing things and all the rest of it. And he goes, well, no, the whole idea of Lee Nelson is a reformed character. He's from that industry. There's a class element to it. There's a social element to it, but he's a good guy. Because he has to be a good guy, because ultimately you've got to sat there listening to an ad to a bloke you hate. Mm-hmm. Well, nobody wants to do that. So you've got to have... He's got to be lovable rogue.
Yes, he's charming, isn't he? He's naive about some things, he's crafty about others, yeah.
Absolutely, lovable rogue, right? But you have to learn a lot to learn what you're not knowledgeable about. So what someone says there from Sheffield, you need to know a lot about Sheffield so we can know what he doesn't know about Sheffield.
Sure.
Right, you know, sure. So we write a routine
about
that.
Sure, okay, yeah, great.
Right, so each of you those ideas, I'm going to come up with some of those ideas with him, but they will come from him, mm-hmm. because he's a character, an excellent character, and in the mind of that character, and then be able to do it. And it's hilarious because you watch this process and you see how many hours go into it and they're finessing it, and then it'll appear on TV and then you look at the comments and they'll just go, well, it's just a bloke just being a chav, isn't it? I see that at the bottom of my street all the day. I mean, where's the skill in that?
Yeah.
And you sit there and think, there is some, I promise. So that's Simon. But that's unique to him. I had to learn very quickly his method of writing, and it's and he wouldn't say that to me, but that's how I understand it to be.
Sure, right? Sure.
And then writing with Sean Walsh. Sean Walsh is your classic how people think comics, right? You get together in the pub, you have a pint, you talk about something, you cry loads about laughing, then you remember to write bits of it down, and then you try and turn it into a routine. Sean has grown up watching me doing comedy, which is very odd.
Yes.
So his methods are quite similar to mine.
Yes. Okay.
But so he still writes verbatim rather than notes. In other words, we write word for word what the joke, how the joke looks. Less so for Simon, to be honest. Because once he knows how a joke works, he doesn't need it written verbatim.
Yes,
he's a memory bank for it. Mm-hmm. And then Sean will then do the flourishes that turn it into a great routine. Mm-hmm. But also, he's very McIntyre. You know, he wants his observations to be stuff that everybody knows.
Yes.
He absolutely has no interest in stuff that he needs to explain. Mm-hmm. If he needs to explain something, it's not worth doing.
Okay.
So if it's how stupid someone looks when they bump their head when they get off the bus, mm-hmm. if it's how people choose not to use a travelator in an airport, that's it. That's the sentence. That's all the information you need. It never, ever... There's no jokes of Sean's require explanation.
Okay.
And so you think, oh, God, I'm having to do really narrow stuff. And you're thinking, well, narrower than that, because he doesn't really do jokes about sex and stuff, which is surprising.
Mm.
But actually, he's quite a external, not an internal person. You know, he'll say things like, I can't be bothered to do this, or I don't understand this. But he won't say, I feel this about this.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So it's man meets world with Sean, or even boy meets world in some perspective. And it's something that everybody notices, and it doesn't involve stuff that's base, that will give people an opinion about him.
Yes.
So in that respect, he's very much like McIntyre.
Okay.
because McIntyre is the man of the people.
Sure.
Despite being someone that everyone looks at and thinks, I don't know anyone like you.
Yes, yes, yeah, that's a very good point.
you know, nobody's got a mate. Oh, he's just like McIntyre.
Sure.
Whereas
sure,
everyone's going, sure. I've got a mate like Mickey Flanagan.
Yes, yes, yes.
I've got a mate like Jeff Innocent.
So it's about, so from your perspective, it's about how you bring yourself to those processes and to those people. Have you ever tried working with someone and it didn't work because you couldn't get into their perspective?
Totally.
Yeah.
Russell Howard.
Okay.
Russell really rates me as a writer. Okay. Asked me to come and write with him on What the Week. Asked with him to write on his show,
mm-hmm.
and I could come up with loads of funny stuff. And I just could tell it just wasn't in his voice.
Sure.
So pointless.
Sure.
You know, and this is the most depressing thing, probably because he is just a little bit far enough away from me that it's a generational rather than a perception difference.
Yes. Okay.
Frightening, isn't it?
Yeah.
For a 39-year-old to be going, I'm too old to understand why you find that funny.
Yes, because his audience is, well, because he's younger than you.
Hey,
and
look,
his audience.
Russell
is
Howard
than
existed before his audience.
Yeah.
Russell Howard was doing things that Russell Howard found funny, and he's an excellent stand-up. Mm. And then his audience turned up for it. I sometimes feel a bit sad because Russell Howard's actual audience should be much wider and broader than it currently is, because his material is so accessible.
God, I remember seeing him do our shows at Edinburgh years and years ago and just crying with laughter. I thought he was amazing.
But also, that audience, it
wasn't a teeny bopper.
Exactly.
Audience.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. And yet, his audience is moulding into that. But maybe it's because he appeals to everyone, mm-hmm. that very, very few comics appeal to that demographic.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
It's not the fact that he's not attractive to middle-aged people or sort of couples in their 30s and that.
Sure.
It's the fact that those other people have got very few other comics they can go to.
Yes.
So I mean, that's the case. So yeah. So no, absolutely. There are people who are who rate me as a writer, but ultimately hasn't worked. And then the other person he's writing with is Russell Cain, and that is nothing like anything else I've ever done before in my life.
Okay.
Well, you're not writing. You're micro directing.
Okay.
You do not sit down and come up with ideas for jokes with him. You listen to him talk about something. You throw in an idea, be it a word or a concept, and you listen to him go off on one, and then you write it down or you record it on your phone with frightening rate because he's talking at 10 to the dozen, and then you go, that bit you've just said there, that will work really well with that routine there.
Okay.
And that
okay.
routine you did there, if you put that on the back of that, then you can refer back to that. And you basically, he just, it's like, he's like a one-man band and he's playing five different songs on five different instruments simultaneously,
yeah.
and it's learning to disseminate that information,
sure.
and put it back together so it's a harmony, you know. And the fact is, Russell doesn't probably need me. The reason why he needs me is because there are not enough hours in the day to get through the amount of work he has to do.
Okay.
And he would be able to do everything I'm doing for him, everything, but he doesn't have the time.
Sure.
So I am there effectively as a comedy PA.
You seem, for someone that has such involvement with acts who have a bigger profile and one would imagine a bigger wage than you, you seem very comfortable to be in that role of the person helping.
Do you know why? And this is weird, because people would think, doesn't that dent your ego? Quite the opposite. What it does is remind me that the level I'm at, where I have very, very little profile, though I'm very well known within the industry,
sure,
probably
sure.
have fingers in every pie really, but is the fact that the actual talent difference is quite small.
Mm.
You know, the comic who earns, it's a linear relationship up until the last 10%, and then it becomes exponential. If you were to draw a graph of talent versus earnings and profile,
okay,
it's linear, exponential.
Yes,
right?
Okay.
You know, people, that whole Jimmy Carr taxing, and people looking at, you know, half people looking at, oh, how much tax he's avoiding. All the comments are going, how much money is he earning?
Yes, yes.
Right? They weren't concerned about how much tax they're paying. They wanted how much money he was earning. Is a comic who earns, any comic who earns £1 million a year, 10 times funnier than one that earns 100,000?
Sure.
No.
No, of course.
Are they doubly funny? Probably not. They're probably, I'd say, 15% funnier, maybe
okay.
20% max.
Okay.
Okay, so thinking, right, well, in that case, why isn't that person those other people as well known, because that last 15-20% is really important. Mm-hmm. That last 15-20% is the reason why you can go for a really good meal, or you could go to a meal at a Michelin star restaurant. Mm-hmm. Surely all those restaurants would be Michelin star. They're not, because they don't have that finesse to be able to turn a plate of food into a piece of art, to do something. They think, well, how does anyone else do that? To do something better, you know. You know, and that's why the best restaurants cost 10 times the price of a, you know, a harvester or something like that. You know, it's, the food is better. It's not 100 times better, but it, but that the skill required to go there is so much more important. So so by writing with other people, you'd think, well, you know, what's I'm giving my best ideas to bigger names and all the rest of it. Well, I'm not, because as I've kind of determined, so much about writing for other people is about getting into their voice and their perspective. There are crossovers, there are jokes I write for other people and I think, oh, I'd like that myself. But they're the minority.
Right? Are you ever tempted when writing for or writing with someone else? Do you ever come up with a thing and then not say it because you think, actually, I'll put that in my back pocket?
No, I think that's cheeky, because you're sat in a room being paid at that point in time, because you're paid by the hour. Yeah. So at that point in time, you're being paid by somebody else. It's a bit like when people go to university and they write a paper on something scientific, and then they think, I'll go and sell that elsewhere, and the university goes, I own that, and they go, well, I came up with it. No, they kind of employed you. The university owns it, you know. I think that's fair. No, I think the what has happened, and certainly the case with Simon Brockin, is I've come up with a joke, he's gone, that's great, he's used it, it hasn't worked for him, and I said, can I have it back?
Sure.
And that's happened.
Sure.
So I've got a few jokes that I've written for him that he didn't want, but obviously never. And I've given jokes as well. I've had jokes that I've retired from my set that have worked better for other people.
Okay.
And then once I've done that, I won't do them again.
Okay.
Sometimes I make a mistake and I say them on stage. I think, ah, I gave that one away, didn't I? But thankfully, I'm prolific. I'm writing all the time. So, you know, I'm generating enough that there is enough there.
There's a question that sometimes I like to ask certain people, and I ask it of myself, because it comes from me. Whenever I have the joy of having had a really funny idea, for me, it's always slightly tempered with the idea, the fear that, what if it's my last one? What if I run out one day?
Oh, that's now, ridiculous paranoia based in nothing.
There's the answer then.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous. Yeah. Who sits and composes a song and then goes, that'll be the last one, all other songs have been done, that's it, there's not enough notes left, there's not enough notes to get into the correct order to make another song, that's it, that's my last song ever? Well, because every song's ever been written, isn't it? I mean, look at it. I mean, like, the Beatles had it easy because people, there hadn't been enough songs. That was ridiculous. Let's talk about mathematical probabilities, right? Let's look at it, right? A musical note is, on a scale, how many are there? Is it 13 or 17 or something? I don't know, right? Okay, and then you have four of those in a bar, assuming you're a four beat and like this, and then you got a chorus, and fair enough. 13 to the power of 13, four times that by a page, times that by, you know, just, it's, you're talking billions, trillions, zillions of possibilities, and comedy's made up of words, intonations, gaps, inferences, understandings. You know, the whole idea of Freud said there's only four jokes. He was Austrian. They had very shit comedy clubs in Austria. All right, okay, it's just, there is so many parameters involved in the generation and the delivery of a joke. There is no chance that you'll ever run out. And more importantly, comedy isn't a static beast. As I think I had this chat with you recently, but I've had this chat with a few other people as well. I was talking to Joe Caulfield actually about this in the Comedy Store last week. If you leave comedy as a comic and you say, oh, do you know what? I'm going to travel the world for a year and come back. When you come back, you will not just be rusty because you haven't been doing comedy and so you're not up to speed with it. Your delivery, material, and whole persona will be a year out of date.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
When comics stop improving, they automatically go backwards. Mm-hmm. It's not just because the people coming into the industry are getting funnier and better and all the rest of it, though they are. I mean, I see some extraordinarily confident and competent open spots nowadays, and it frightens me because I remember just how rubbish I was for the first 2 years. Yeah. Right? But it moves. What makes people laugh changes. What people expect people to say changes. People's parameters and what an acceptable joke is changes. People saying, oh, you know, everything's been done now, you know, there are no holds barred in stand-up, so the alternative circuit covers all bases. You can talk about paedophilia, you can talk about, you know, raping the queen or whatever it is people do, you know, like, because you can say about anything now, it's not going to get any, you know, it's not going to, of course it constantly is moving on. People's terms of references are changing, people's expectations of what is funny is changing, people's language is changing. Do you know what I mean? Like, this, you know, 6 months ago, 50 Shades of Grey joke. Woo! Yeah. A month ago, Gangnam Style joke. Right, years time, what a load of wank.
Yeah,
no, people
yeah.
have no interest in it whatsoever. So, you know, because we reflect society, because we're working on the in the industry of observation, and the world is a dynamic place, then so is comedy. So, daft. I think the worst thing you can do is convince yourself that and stop writing, because then your comedy goes backwards. There are people who I looked up to when I started in comedy going, that is incredible. How do you do that? That's amazing. I'll never be able to do that. And now I see them and they're doing something similar to when I started them, and I think that's rubbish.
Mm.
Right? And the only reason why it's rubbish is because they didn't change.
Mm.
Terrible, isn't it?
Brilliant, brilliant. Yeah. No, I mean, it is terrible. What I mean is that was a brilliant and comprehensive answer, which in the first instance sounded very, very mathematic and very mathematical, rather, and very scientific until you used the word zillions. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, this guy's making it up.
It's a million million. A zillion is a million million.
That's not a real term.
A zillion is a million million.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Hey!
That's brilliant.
Right. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And if you do want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Stephen C. Grant. Or it's stephengrant.com.
Terrific.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
Hooray.
So thanks to Stephen, an incredibly comprehensive interview there, and a really convincing argument, I thought, for Edinburgh as a place to try new ideas. Imagine such a thing. So loads more stuff available on that, on all sorts of subjects from Stephen at www.comedianscomedian.com/Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all my technical support people. If you're coming to the live special next week, you'll be getting an email with the location very soon. And I'll see you there.
Oh, you were right. You were right.
I'm leaving that in. I'm bloody leaving this
a bit. A zillion is a very large indefinite number.
Yeah.
Usually hyperbole.